This is an interview with Gary and Bernice Webster on April 2nd, 2003, in their home in the Grande Ronde Valley. Would you both tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in La Grande on October 30th, 1934. And
your parents had lived in La Grande for some years?
My mother had been around this county most of her life.
What was your maiden name then?
My maiden name was Howard. My father was from Idaho. Mm. And my mother had relatives in Idaho and went out there to 2 years of high school. And she met my dad then, and they were married. And she came back to La Grande to be with family when I was born.
What was your father's occupation?
He worked in sheep camps.
Sheep camps?
Uh-huh. And he also worked on gold dredges.
And one in Sumter?
No, in Idaho.
I see.
And he died at a very young age. He died when I was two. He had an attack of appendicitis, and his appendix ruptured, and he died of peritonitis. And I had a brother who was 6 weeks old.
She was born in a house on, was it X or Y?
I'm not sure what the street is down there.
The north side.
Mm-hmm.
North side.
In my aunt's house.
Gary, you were born when and where?
Well, I was born November 19th, 1934. I'm an only child, and I was born in the house that my younger daughter, Stacy Webster, now lives in. It's approximately 11 miles from La Grande on Webster Road. And I don't know how much more you
well
want to know.
The Webster family is one that's been around Union County for some years. Give me a thumbnail history of the Webster family.
Well, the name Webster, my grandfather came to this valley apparently, and I'm not quite certain of the year. My daughter Vicki probably has that in her thesis, but he served as a deputy sheriff for his brother Wesley Webster, and then he went to work as a bridge foreman when the forerunner of Union Pacific Railroad came into existence, and he built or was in charge of building the bridge near Oradell, just to the west of La Grande. And he got into the field of farming basically because his father-in-law, who was John Webster, had taken back or repurchased, 160 acres of land from a Dutch homesteader by the name of Henry Booker, who was single and who wanted to, after a number of years of homesteading, wanted to go back to the old country, back to the Netherlands.
Was that B-O-O-K-E-R?
Yes, B-O-O-K-E-R, yes. And my grandmother, one grandmother in the Van Blocklin side, was married to my grandfather, William Webster, who took up farming, and they had six children, one of whom died of diphtheria, and the other five survived to adulthood. And my grandfather, William Webster, died in 1925, we think, of prostate cancer.
Where was the Webster farming land exactly?
Well, it's it's on Webster Road. It's 11 miles northeast of La Grande. You come out Hunter, you turn right on Monroe, go a mile and three quarter on a gravel road, and then turn a quarter mile left or north on Webster, and it's right off that corner. And the it was a homestead house when the Websters purchased it, and then they built a new home in 1916, which still stands.
Do you know who had homesteaded it?
Henry Booker homesteaded it.
Oh, I see. How long was he here, do you think?
You know, I'm really not certain. I'm really not certain because I hesitate to mention some of this. Apparently my great-grandfather, John Van Blocklin, was a shrewd land trader.
That would have been John.
That would have been John.
Mm-hmm.
And he was responsible, I am told, through numerous grandchildren, of getting several Dutch settlers, usually young men in their late teens, early 20s, to come into this valley. And because the Land Donation Act, I think the Homestead Act, went into effect in 1962 under Lincoln. 1862.
Yeah, right.
under Abraham
correct.
Lincoln.
Yes.
And I've forgotten the specifics of that, but I think if you fessed up on land for 3 years or 5 years, it became yours.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry Booker was single. He was apparently 18, 19 years of age. And he was here for, I would guess, 20 years or so. Apparently never married. Got homesick for the homeland. At that time, the Dutch, in some ways, and certainly it came out in World War I, were persecuted because they did not know English or knew only broken English. And there were very few females around. And one by one, I am led to understand by descendants of John Van Blocklin, that young Dutch men would get homesick for the motherland and want to return to Holland, to the Netherlands. And John Van Blocklin, for a team of horses, or the train had come through in 1884, I believe, would pay their trip for their train trip back to New York, where they could catch a boat back to the Netherlands. And he acquired, I am told, considerable amounts of land in this valley through, some said that he was a shrewd trader, and that he probably realized when he brought them over that they might stay 5, 7, 10 years and then wish to go back, and generally many or most of them did. And according to my daughter, Vicky Bergiotti, in her thesis, I think this has to be an exaggeration, but she was told by two or three of the grandsons who were living at that time when she was writing her thesis, which was about 1979 or 80, that you could go from LeGrand to Somerville without stepping off of Van Blocklin land. And they lost it basically through high living before the Depression.
Well, it might not have been an exaggeration if you say he was shrewd, and there were a number of people around here who didn't want to have very deep roots. But that's beside the point, because it no longer exists as an empire, right?
They lost all of it
yeah.
ahead of the Great Depression. It's in this thesis.
Yeah, yes.
Excuse me.
You were born near where we're sitting right now.
About a mile.
You went to school in several schools, you told me earlier. Let's start with the first one.
Okay, I started first grade in Iowa at the age of 5, and there was one teacher for grades 1 through 8.
This was the Iowa school.
Iowa school. It was
now,
at the corner of Stanley and Monroe and Hunter.
Right. And was it demolished?
No.
Or is that the one?
It was moved, I believe, probably in the late 1950s. That could be determined by someone else. And it is setting right near the corner of Black Hawk Trail and Fox Hill Road, right across from the
fairgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes, I've seen that. I didn't realize that had been the Iowa school, however.
That was the, I'm not sure it was the original Iowa school, but that was the Iowa school. There was a horse barn, and there was a little bicycle barn,
uh-huh.
and it was a pitcher pump and 2 outhouses.
Uh-huh. How vividly do you remember your experiences in first grade?
Quite well.
Yes?
There was one other little first grade girl, and the teacher said that, told my parents, that Dad was a director. There were 3 directors in the Iowa district, and Mother was clerk.
Uh-huh.
of the Iowa district. And they did not want to take me. The teacher did not want to take me because I was underage. But they needed, as I understand it, to have a minimum of 10 students to keep a rural district going according to state education laws. And there were 7, and apparently they could squeeze by if they had 8 or 9. A lady by the name of Pauline Johnson, she and her husband ran the Puller Fur Farm, which is up on Mink Road. They had minks. She taught grades 1 through 8. And apparently I did well enough that I went the first and second grade to Iowa. The one girl is still living. She's a wife of Don Waldrop, who has Waldrop Oil. Lila Waite was her name. There were no second graders. There was a third grader by the name of his last name was Ockletree. There was a fourth grader by the name of Eloise Tucker. A fifth grader by the name of Wilma Campbell, and she lives out of Cove. And a sixth grader by the name of Frances Ockletree, girl, female. And 2 7th grade boys, Kermit Hulse and Paul Ockletree.
Do you remember all those names because
yes,
you have reunions?
No. No. I've never seen most of them since.
I don't remember the names of my classmates when
but
I was
there's
first.
Only, were there only 7, though?
It does make a difference. What's your best information about why it was called the Iowa School?
My best information, and I didn't know this at all at the time, but in fact, my folks were not in Iowa District. They were in what was called Lone Star School District, which was on the Sand Ridge. But Lone Star had ceased holding classes in 1934, the year I was born. And Lone Star consolidated into Iowa. And I have only found this out recently, and I think it's accurate, because the Iowa community of homesteaders came from the state of, basically came from the state of Iowa, and I suppose they were the ones that erected the school. I went the first and second grade to Iowa, and then the 2 7th grade boys, having graduated out of the 8th grade, had to leave and go to high school, and there were no new kids coming in. And that dropped it down to 6, and they forced Iowa to close. And my parents lived 4 miles from Imbler, and I went the 3rd, 4th, and 5th grades to Imbler. And Pauline Johnson and her husband, who were somewhat social friends of my parents, she left and went to Imbler and was a music teacher and I believe an English teacher at Imbler. And she told my folks at the end of 3 years at Imbler, in the 5th grade, she says, "Get Gary out of Imbler. It's not challenging enough for him." And my folks fought a court battle and won. My folks' residence, where my daughter Stacy lives, where I was born and raised, the Booker Homestead, is 4 miles from Imbler and 11 miles from LeGrand. And if you look around at the district lines in this valley, you know there were 65 or 70 school districts, and LeGrand does go within 2.5 or 3 miles of Imbler. It goes within about 3 or 4 miles of Cove. It goes past Hot Lake. And basically, the consolidation into LeGrand at that time apparently took place because those in the powers that be in LeGrand, I assume the Board of Education superintendent, realized that there was a lot of what they call, quote, rich farm ground with very few students. And property tax being the main source of income, LeGrand was able to garner much of the valley's land and property tax coming into LeGrand rather than the smaller rural districts. And the folks were not well liked, particularly in Imbler, because they did fight this court battle. And I can recall, even after I was married, that there were older folks that remembered what had gone on and would not speak to my parents.
What was the specific purpose of the suit?
It was to consolidate Iowa with Lone Star into La Grande, because Imbler wanted us in Imbler District, and Imbler ran the first buses in this county. They were 3 years before La Grande started running buses.
And your parents wanted this because they thought Imbler wasn't challenging enough for you?
I don't think it was necessarily they thought that, but the teacher, Pauline Johnson, told my folks that.
But they had decided that they needed a suit in order to get you into a La Grande school.
Apparently, my parents were going to be forced into Imbler because they lived, as I say, 4 miles versus 11. And Imbler had buses and La Grande didn't.
Uh-huh. Bernice, your early school experience was in La Grande, was it?
I started school in Huntington, Oregon, where my mother lived after my dad passed away.
I didn't realize you had left La Grande
for
a while there.
And we lived there for 6 years. So I went to, I started third grade there, and my mother had married a railroader by the name of Floyd Hagee. And he was transferred to La Grande.
Nice.
And so we moved to La Grande probably in October of my third grade year, and then I went to Ackerman through the rest of grade school.
I see. Tell me a little about the Ackerman experience, as specifically as you can. It often is cited as being rather different from going to school in the other La Grande elementary schools.
Yes, I'm sure it is. You had a teacher for every class, and then according to terms you had like two student teachers in the morning and two student teachers in the afternoon, and so each one of Ackerman's classrooms had like two rooms in it, and they divided classes
like
up
fourth and fifth together, or
well
fifth
no
and
I'm
sixth.
I'm talking about to accommodate the student teachers. They would take part of the class, and the supervising teacher would take the rest of the class.
But weren't several of them combined grades?
I only had 1 year when we had a fourth and fifth that I was in a combined class.
Did you thrive?
No. I was very shy when I moved to La Grande, and it took a while for me to make friends. I had very good friends there, but I was adjusting to a new stepfather and a new town. My grandmother had lived with us in Huntington and took care of us while my mother worked, and it was just a totally different environment. I guess I was an average student.
I think there's quite a if I might intercede. I think there's quite a cultural shock coming from Huntington, Oregon to La Grande, and Ackerman was perceived as the school that many professors sent their kids to, and I don't know about doctors so much, teachers, professors and teachers, and many of the students that she went to Ackerman with were pretty fair students.
One nice thing about Ackerman was that the college professors taught art and music and PE, and so we had all three of those classes that other grade schools in La Grande at that time did not have.
Do you know why your mother, if she was the one who made the decision, decided to have you go there rather than one of the other La Grande elementary schools? If you were living on the north side, time were you living on the north
side? No,
we
lived on K Avenue, which was right under the Ackerman.
Well, the old Central School near the high school would have been the choice then for you, wouldn't it?
When we moved here and Mother was taking us to school to enroll us, we were going to Central. And we climbed up 8th Street Hill, which is blocked off now, and it was very, very cold. It was in the fall, and there was a really cold wind, and Mother just couldn't stand to think about us walking clear to Central the whole winter, so she stopped at Ackerman, and they took us in.
when you said K, it was the bottom of K down under College Hill.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that was really the reason we started at Ackerman.
Do you recall being aware at the time of attitudes that other children or adults had about people who went to Ackerman?
I think that the Ackerman kids were considered by the other grade schools to be elitist.
And therefore, what behavior? What behavior did the other kids have toward Ackerman kids?
We all came together, all the grade schools in LeGrand came together in the eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And we were in the old central building. And I seemed to make friends very easily when I got into the eighth grade.
You weren't taunted from having been at
Ackerman? Not really taunted, but I think there was, personally, I never felt better than anybody else because I went to Ackerman. But I think that the other kids perceived that. And but I think when we came together in the eighth grade, we melded in pretty fast. Don't you feel that?
We had a 1 year middle school, mm-hmm. eighth grade. It was unique in Oregon.
And that's where you went after Iowa?
I went the first, second to Iowa, third, fourth, and fifth to Imbler, sixth and seventh to Greenwood. And in eighth grade, Fred Patton was the superintendent, and apparently it was unique in the state of Oregon. I've heard that Klamath Falls had a one-year eighth middle school. They called it junior high. They didn't call it middle school. And then a four-year high school. Mm-hmm. And we were at the one-year junior high on the, were we in the top story of the old central building? Central school had...
No, we were in the bottom.
We were in the bottom, weren't we?
And we had some classes in the high school. We went over to the high school for PE and for music.
That was all, yeah, PE and music.
We had tell me a little about the conditions for learning at Central School, the routines you went through, the kinds of textbooks and other materials you had, the teacher's methods, discipline, those kinds of things.
Well, most of the teachers were very strong disciplinarians, and they didn't put up with very much. And at that time, teachers still were allowed to...
Corporal punishment.
Yes, spank.
And they did.
And they did.
And
they also... Well, I had one teacher who had the sole off of a tennis shoe that was about that long that he used. Ridicule, particularly to these smarty boys. They were pretty much ridiculed. One teacher that we had who was a math teacher, and she just died a couple of years ago, she'd set the boys under her desk.
What kinds of infractions would bring punishments like those?
Chewing gum, talking.
Yep, exactly.
Being unruly. We never talked back to a teacher. I mean, if you did, you would be trouble.
Would it be accurate to say that fear was prevalent in the classrooms?
I wouldn't say fear so much. You respected your teacher.
But if they ridiculed you, how could you respect them?
I don't know. You just did.
It was a respect that came from the fact that teachers wore dresses, men basically wore suits, and when Riveria closed last year, my younger daughter is a teacher at Island City first grade, but she taught kindergarten at Riveria, and I was looking through some of the 50s and 60s booklets of classes in Riveria, and you could be suspended for school for 3 days for chewing gum. And that's in one of the Riveria.
I have to say that I loved most of my teachers.
I did too.
But I wasn't a child who was in trouble. You know, I behaved and followed the rules pretty much.
I rode the school bus, and the bus driver was a man by the name of Vern Berry, and he had a rubber hose about this long. And the boys just loved it. We'd make spit wads all night, and I'd put the rubber bands under my arm all the way up to my elbow, because, you know, they do break once in a while.
Under your sleeve.
Under your sleeve, yes. And it sat on that 66-passenger bus, you know, boing, boing. And, but every once in a while, you'd get caught, because he would see you, and he'd come back with a rubber hose, and he'd whack you a good one.
Stop the bus and
make
a spectacle of the wrongdoer.
Oh, yes. And the roads weren't built up. The grades weren't built. Bar pits were not deep like they are now. And during the winter months, he would have basically the bigger kids, well, all the weight that could, set in the back of the bus so they could get, the bus could get more traction as it go through. And they would try to ram through any east-west road that was today that buses would not even attempt to get through. And many times we'd be stalled for 2 or 3 hours out in the middle of a raging blizzard in the valley, waiting for some help from somebody else. They didn't have cell phones. And I guess after so long a time, somebody didn't come looking for you.
Do you recall very much homework?
Yes.
Did you do
it? I don't recall a exorbitant amount. How about you?
Seems like we had homework every night. Probably just a page in a class. Mm-hmm. Math, I recall, because that was the subject that I wasn't very good in.
What would be the conditions for getting that homework done?
My mother, just after dinner, we just did homework.
Supervised, or?
Yes.
Exactly how did you go about this? Did you sit at the dining room table, for example?
We sat at the kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And my mother didn't work out of the home. She was home. And after we got our homework done, we listened to radio programs. Of course, that was before TV. And every evening while we were doing our radio programs, we'd eat canned peaches and toast. And so it was just a rule in our house that you did it.
About a half an hour's work then after dinner, and then the radio?
Probably. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a long time to me.
Oh, yes. Especially if you're being forced to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mine wasn't supervised. I really think I worked for quite a bit more than a half hour. But it wasn't supervised. Could I jump back just one little interesting tidbit about Iowa school? War II started, the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. And Pauline Johnson, our teacher, husband, I don't know whether he was drafted, I think he was called to duty, Don Johnson. By the way, he later came back and became a teacher in LeGrand High School. And they're both still living, and they live in Boise, Idaho. But I can recall him going away to war, and him coming to one room, which was maybe as big as these two rooms together, and saying goodbye to the eight of us kids. And I was, again, just a five-year-old, or maybe six by that time. I guess I'd just turned six. And I was absolutely panic-stricken that Japanese planes were going to come over Mount Emily and bomb Iowa school. I can remember that, and every morning I would look up at the mountain, and I expected to see planes, and I expected that we were going to be bombed. That's very vivid in my memory.
What do you think fed your imagination that would happen?
Well, her husband going off to war, number one, and then I had two uncles that went into the service.
But what made you connect going into the service with having Japanese planes come across the Pacific Ocean?
Well, I really don't know, other than my folks were pretty well up on news events and history. Mm-hmm. They weren't people that just sat, even though there was no TV. We went to movies, and they had the newsreels, 15-minute newsreels, or 18-minute, whatever they were, and we watched, can't even remember their names now, the old RKO programs preceding the movie.
Movietone News.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and had three theaters in the Grand.
In Huntington, we had blackouts.
Yes, and we did.
And everybody had to have blackout curtains. And there was a warden who walked around, made sure that you had your lights out. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, I don't know as I was scared about being bombed, but that was frightening. You have to turn
Huntington
your lights
was
out
turn
set
around,
in the dark.
Yeah. The railroad, yeah. You know what that is. Mm-hmm. Okay.
There were also plane spotters around here.
Yes.
Supposedly looking for...
I do remember in the middle of the night, if you'd wake up and hear a plane going over, it was kind of scary. But I'm not sure that I really equated it with bombing. I really, you know, I don't really know what I equated the fear with now. It's been too many years.
I think for a brief period of time, they did walk a railroad bridge or two also.
Oh, they walked the railroad yards.
Yes. There were armed guards at various places, yes. On bridges, especially in tunnels. Other narrators have told us about this. Mm-hmm. Anything else about the Central School, Middle School experience that's vivid in your memories?
We certainly had the basics, which is, I think, more than you can say now. And I've spent 12, I was on the LeGrand School Board for 12 years, and I think I know. But the teachers, you got a very good base in English and in arithmetic and math and science.
You were excellent readers.
Yes. You were excellent readers. Basically, you were an excellent
reader.
Even
average students were excellent readers.
Yes. Yes. Diagramming sentences. At our class reunion, we had our 50th last summer, and Betty Ragsdale was the only teacher that's still around, and I asked the class, I said, she was there in attendance, and I said, how many of you know what a split infinitive is, or a dangling participle, or a gerund? And, you know, I couldn't begin to tell you what they are, but one of the kids says, I don't know what they are, but I can sure diagram them.
That's a controversial subject. Mm-hmm. As a former English teacher, I'm up on the controversy. right after high school, did you have a little interval of further education before you took up farming?
Well, I, like I say, I went to Greenwood 6th and 7th, Central 8th, which was middle school, and 4 years of Grand High School, and then I went straight to college in the fall of 1952. And you said EOC, but it was EOCE at that time. And the year that I graduated, I was one of the first three students in spring of 1956 that was had a Bachelor of Science in General Studies. I did not get a BS in education, or I don't have a BA because I didn't have another language. It was a BS, and there were two others and myself.
What led to your choice of EOCE as the college that you would go to? There were certainly other choices, weren't there?
Didn't have the money. Farming was pretty frugal at that time. My folks did not have a large farm, and I had a girlfriend, for heaven's sake. She lived in LeGrand. I couldn't have afforded to have gone to college anywhere else. I always knew I was probably going to farm. But my rationale was, and it's been borne true many times with friends of our kids and friends of ours and their kids, my parents pretty well felt that a person needed to get an education before they got married and started having children. And that We've seen so many cases of where somebody would go to a prestigious university, a Stanford or an MIT or something, which would be wonderful, or Oregon State even, or Washington, and they would have enough money to last out a term or two, and then they'd have to come back and work for a term or two or a year, and then to go back for another term or two, and then they'd fall in love and they'd get married, and they'd try to go back and work, and they'd get about 2 or 3 years of education, and they'd finally give it up. And where my folks really instilled in me the fact that if I didn't always want a farm, that I could probably go out, and when I graduated, I could have taught in Idaho. Not in Oregon, but in Idaho.
Plus the fact that he helped his father on weekends and,
vacation
times.
I helped on weekends.
Well, tell me a little more about the conditions of a student life at Eastern Oregon College of Education at that period.
Well, there were the kids who traversed back and forth, and then there was the townies, the kids that lived in the dormitories.
Were you driving back and forth each day?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm not sure what you wanted me to tell. I enjoyed college very much. I've always enjoyed school. I was a good student. I was able to stay out of the tail end of the Korean War because my grades were in the top third, top 33%. And I was heavy in social sciences and in history and in literature were my subjects, which about all you can really do in those fields is teach, where in many other, in your science math fields, you can go on to become many things.
You can also live a richer life by knowing some of those things.
Yes. But I loved history, and I loved literature and geography, that type of thing. I was in theater, and I was president of Sock and Buskin. I was in 4 or 5 plays, and I was in I was very involved in politics.
Where were the plays produced at that time?
In Lowell, in the theater.
In the main auditorium there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wasn't called in low at that time, mm-hmm. but the administration building.
Mm-hmm. Gary also had a beautiful singing voice, has a beautiful singing voice, and he was always involved in music.
I was in Blue and Gold Singers, mm-hmm. and briefly in a quartet. I was very active in politics, and I guess you would say the reason, or there were more than one reason, returning. And this may fly in your face, returning students coming back from the Korean War were basically all Democrats. And they'd been around the world, and they loved to play poker and chase girls and drink all weekend. And I was pretty much of a prude. And I didn't care for that. My folks were Rock River Republicans, and so basically I was in Young Republicans, and I was also in IRC, International Relations Club, under Joe Geiser. And Joe Geiser took 12 or 14 of us to the Model United Nations, the 10th anniversary of its founding at the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco. And I forget what, I think we represent Egypt. But we went in 1954. The UN apparently was formed in 1944, the War Memorial Opera House. And so I considered myself a big world traveler. And then the next year they held the 11th anniversary in Corvallis at OSU, and we went again that year. And I was quite vocal, probably obnoxious. Again, you may not like to hear some of these things.
That doesn't matter what I like to hear.
At that time, Wayne Morse was at the epitome of his power as a United States Senator, and very well liked and very well respected. and the Hells Canyon dams were big issues. I was campaign manager for Sam Kuhn, who was 2nd Congressional District, who Al Ullman finally defeated. And I can recall going into Wallowa County, trying to spread the word. I can't even remember who ran against Morda. It was the governor, McKay. But also basically for Sam Kuhn. And we had these loudspeakers mounted on top of vehicles, and we would go through Wallowa Enterprise and Joseph. It's so hokey now, it's ridiculous. But blaring out, you know, all the good virtues of basically any Republican candidate. Mm-hmm. And I can recall, I was not a part of this, but I was going with Bernice, and she can remember it too. The Sacagawea Hotel was standing, mm-hmm. and the second story was the ballroom. Mm-hmm. And Wayne Morse was speaking, had a major speech in the SAC ballroom. And there are about a dozen, again, I did not get involved in this, but there are about a dozen young Republicans. That's a hardwood floor, and they had the squeaky chairs. And they positioned themselves in the middle of the other huge group of people. And just when Wayne Morse would get to a very important point in his talk, and you know, he was quite a flamboyant speaker. I'm sure you have to know Wayne Morse. One or two of them would get up and have to get out and go to the door. Well, everybody had this. Go back, and you know, and there's all this squeak squawks, and you know, it was
embarrassing.
Civil disobedience, I guess you'd call it. But it was all planned. I can remember that.
Well, while we're on the subject of politics, I'd be very curious to have your version of what it meant in the 1940s and 50s to be a rock-ribbed Republican in Union County.
Very much a minority. Very much a minority.
Are you sure of that?
Yes. It was in Union County, it's 3-2 Democrat registration.
Well, maybe then we should talk about what kinds of ideas
Neuberger
people held in Union County that would have made the Republicans a minority.
Well, Morse, of course, started out in politics as a Republican, and then he switched to independent. Yeah. And did he ever become a Democrat? I believe he did.
I think he was primarily an independent.
Yeah, he certainly was. The Tiger in the Senate. Mm-hmm. You ever read that book? And Richard Neuberger. I honestly can't tell you, other than I think it was a residue left over from War II and Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, and the fact that Dewey was not liked. Thomas Dewey.
Residue, you mean an antagonism toward FDR's policies?
No. People loved FDR. And basically Truman.
Even the rock-red Republicans?
No. I don't mean that. You said what?
Well, what did it mean to be a rock-red Republican, even if it was a minority?
Well, the folks were very conservative. And
socially conservative?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they had no use for FDR. And I can remember when I was 5 or 6 years old of listening to, at late end of the night, listening to when Roosevelt beat Wendell Willkie, and which was basically pretty much a landslide. Of course, before that, Alf Landon, yes, 1936, daughter is Nancy Cassavant. I really don't know why the folks were initial. I basically, it's because of my folks.
That's what I suspected.
Yeah.
I'm one.
They didn't
My parents were Republicans too, and I have never understood why.
Uh-huh.
And maybe you have a better understanding of why yours were.
They didn't like, Roosevelt tried to pack the Supreme Court, 15 members. They did not like that. They felt, now, you know, I'm telling you how they felt.
Yep.
I'm not telling you what maybe.
And they influenced you.
Oh, yeah. They felt that the Depression was starting to get better, that basically Hoover was doing all that he could, and that actually the Depression was deepening prior to War II, and becoming, even with the CCC and WPA and the PWA and all those good things, and I think historians would agree with that, and War II basically, so the precursor of War II, was basically what brought us out of the Depression. That was their consensus. They did not like
this. Well, I think also the farming community was pretty much Republican.
Yes.
Because of, they had to be conservative to make a living. They had conservative views. And they spent only what they needed to spend. You know, they bought only what they had to have. And well, Gary and I have spent most of our lives, if we don't have cash to buy something, we just don't buy it, you know. And I think the social programs that were being brought in at that time, and the increase of that brought in taxes, and of course the land was taxed as well as your income, and I think that had a big bearing on it.
We have a nice house. We built our house. I've got $280 hired labor in this house. It's built on the foundation of an apple warehouse that burned down in 1910. This 80 acres that we have and the 80 acres across the road was originally apple orchard. Mm-hmm. And you've probably been told this by maybe Glenn McKenzie or others. At one time in the 1920s, there was a sign at each end of Imbler, Oregon, says, "Entering Imbler, the apple capital of the USA," before Okanagan and Hood River. Mm-hmm. And
cherries, too, wasn't it?
Yes, cherries, but I know there was a sign regarding apples. And these trees up here were supposedly put in the 1880s. They're about 120 years old.
Bearing apple trees?
Oh, they have apples on them. They're basically, there's only about this much Cambrian bark holding them up. And every time you get a windstorm, it blows over three or four, but they're basically hollow. We have the stock rock, Jonathan's the Roman Beauties, and the few delicious trees. But we keep them up here because they're a windbreak for our cattle, high herd cattle. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting off the subject, but farmers, yeah, our house, we had $280 hired labor in, yeah, in our house. The rock that we got for our house, we got from a quarry up in Mount Glen.
We dug it out.
And we dug it out, and Dad and I built this house. We plumbed it, we wired it, and it took us, we'd go about 15, 20 feet a year. And
I get the sense from you both then that in the 30s, 40s, maybe 50s, the Republican Party, at least in Union County, stood for social conservatism, anti-taxes, stability. Democratic Party, it seemed like big spenders, mm-hmm, too much oriented toward...
Too much government control in your business.
Control, yes, even if the government control was intended to improve the general welfare. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But farmers in particular resented.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that the Republican Party was a minority here at that time because most people weren't so closely related to farming? And therefore their interests would have been different?
We had a lot of railroaders
yes,
in La Grande at that time.
Yes, indeed.
I was raised in a Democratic household. Mm-hmm. And
mill workers.
A lot of mill workers, all labor union people. Mm-hmm. And yes, the farmers were a minority. Mm-hmm. Now, the state of Oregon at that time, I think, was pretty conservative.
But not Union County.
You mentioned going around campaigning for Mr. Kuhn and events such as that. Were you feeling much of the time, or any of the time, strong tensions between people with Democratic or Republican leanings?
Oh, to a degree. Young people are so, they're probably not mature in their thinking, impetuous.
Well, my feeling is the only time you ran into it was at some type of a political gathering. I don't think, you know, a church or socially that they were out sparring around about their
beliefs. Wasn't a prominent part of everyday life?
No,
then?
No.
Well, I guess there certainly still are the extremes. Bernice's dad was a labor union Democrat, and I call it the labor union rag that he brought home, that was the gospel. And I cannot think of one thing that he and I agreed on. Not one thing. And not just politics. We did. He was a Chevrolet. He was a General Motors man. And I was a Ford man. he was a great guy, but we didn't. And he was very volatile. And honestly, when we went to vote, when we just turned 21, we were married just before we turned 21. We went together from my junior year of high school till my till junior year of college. In between my junior and senior year of college, I didn't really know how Bernice was going to register. She registered Republican, but I really didn't know.
Because he had dragged me around to all these political meetings.
I
had my mind changed.
I see.
I emceed a lot of meetings, and I was also Barry Goldwater's campaign chairman for several counties in eastern Oregon, and I drove Barry Goldwater Jr., who flew into La Grande, I drove him from La Grande, Ontario.
Well, then also the farm organizations that we belong to, Farm Bureau and...
Farm Bureau in particular.
Cattlemen's.
Cattlemen.
They were...
Very conservative.
Conservative.
Did you identify any newspaper in Union County as being Republican or Democrat? Or did they seem more independent?
Well, the Eastern Oregon Review was... under Sam Shorb, not Sam, whatever he's Shorb, C.J. Shorb, was one that was published one day a week and was very definitely Democrat. The Observer, I really can't tell you.
Their editorials at The Observer were basically, I would say, lean toward Republicans.
Yeah, I think so.
Reflecting the business interests in La Grande, perhaps?
Probably.
Of course, you probably know this as well as I do. The Oregonian basically was a Republican newspaper,
yes.
And the Journal was Democrat.
Yes.
And both of those, I think, I don't know whether that many people take the. Of course, the Journal was out of existence, but I don't know that many people even take the Oregonian anymore. You see in the library, and a few people take it. A lot of people took the Walla Walla Union Bulletin. I imagine it was conservative.
Most likely.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, in hindsight, and I don't want to really go into this because I still have some mixed emotions, but I remember at the college, they had the Kuhn-Neuberger debates. Richard Neuberger was the U.S. Senator and Kuhn was a 2nd District Congressman over the high dams in Hell's Canyon. And at that time, saying at that time, I could see nothing whatever wrong. We did not want the government dams.
PUC.
PUD.
PUD. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, in retrospect, what has happened with the salmon runs, with a number of other things, you really wonder about the wisdom of some of these things 40 years afterward.
Mm-hmm. Certainly do.
And I know you're probably a very good friend of Dick McDaniel's. Dick and I served on the school board together.
I don't know him.
Well, he's big in Blue Mountain Forum. You said.
I know who he is, but
yeah.
I don't know him.
Dick and I used to argue all the time. We were both on the school board. He was as hard-headed as I was. We'd argue just to get each other's goat. But you know, in retrospect, and I think who was it? Said, you know, the older you get, the wiser you get. I must be getting pretty anxious. At least I think I'm wiser than I used to be. I'm still a Republican. In fact, we both are. But it's not as black and white.
We don't attend meetings.
No.
Or
I am a precinct committee member.
I'm primarily interested here in the Republican-Democratic relationships in the earlier years, at least 50 years ago. Shall we get into the subject of farming? Something you have a lot of knowledge about, both of you, I'm sure.
Well, Bernice was a city girl, and she never lived out on a farm or outside the city limits until we were married, and that was a little bit of a change.
You said you were supposing, I'm not trying to shield my eyes,
no.
You said you were supposing from the time you were fairly young that you would farm as a career. Was this because of your parents' expectations, do you think, primarily?
To a fair degree. I think if I'd had brothers or sisters, I never would have farmed. Because I really have a keen interest in other things. And although I think I was a moderate to fairly good farmer, Dad had registered Hereford cattle, and I was an only child. And the folks were, of course, getting on in years. And I had, you might say, dropped in my lap, so to speak. I loved, I think I could have been, I couldn't be now, because I'd kill a kid. But I think I could have been a good teacher. I love music, I loved acting, and I'm a reasonably good artist. At least I think I am. And I like journalism. I really like journalism. I always thought I might would like to work for a newspaper as a reporter. But of course, I never did any of those things. But I never took. Well, of course, at that time there was no agriculture to be had here at Eastern Oregon, and of course I didn't go to Washington State or Oregon State, the cow colleges. What they called them then. But
well, tell me about the kinds of knowledge of what's involved in farming and cattle raising you had acquired by the time you were in high school.
Well, I worked in the summer for my dad, and basically it was haying and wheat harvest. And at that time, they had crews of men. When I started as a small boy, I drove derrick. Call driving derrick on a Mormon derrick.
Explain, yes, but please explain that.
I'm probably not very good at explaining a Mormon. What are you on, Mormon derrick or what?
Mormon derrick, yes.
Well, a Mormon derrick was on wheels and could be moved from field to field, but it had large corner pieces on usually pole frame, and it had a swinging boom. On an axle high up in the air, that on one end was a what they call a Jackson fork. It would drop down and it would pick up loose hay that would be brought in from the field on a buck rake or on a slip, and they would pick up enough to hold a Jackson fork. It was usually four tined and about 3.5 or 4 feet in width, and maybe the tines would go out 2.5 feet, and it would on a cable would go up through the top of the derrick, and it was pulled by a horse. I started out driving a horse, and then when the hay would get up in the middle of a loose stack, the stacker, or sometimes two or three stackers, would yell, "Hitter or tripper, trip it," and they would trip the Jackson fork, and the loose hay would fall on the stack, and then with pitchforks they would kind of arrange the loose hay stack. And a good haystacker could make a stack with a kind of a bulge at the top to keep the weather, the winter storms, from rotting the hay so much. A bulge kind of like the top of a match head, like a match head. Of course, if you weren't a good haystacker, it'd all fall down, too. And I started doing that, and then I drove. I never mowed hay with horses, but I've driven a side delivery rake, and I've driven a buck rake with workhorses. There were two Clydesdales called Dick and Baldy, and then there was another one called Tom and Jerry. And then When the Holt combines first began to be converted over from using horses or mules, in fact, I have never really seen, I've only seen pictures of horses pulling Holt combines, but the Holt combine Dad had was an 18-foot, had an 18-foot header, had four, it was run by four men, and Dad cut off the tongue originally, when it was the Holt combine, when it was new, would go out and the initial horses were, I forget what the back horses were called, hitched to them, and then of course the catbird seat went out in front of the Holt combine, and the catbird driver had I don't know how many lines, I guess it was 28 horses he must have had, I don't know how many. Either 7 or 14 sets of lines that he had to work those horses from. I never saw that, however, but Dad had shortened that tongue up, and it was pulled by a 30 caterpillar, and I drove a 30 cat for about 3 or 4 years.
Do you have pictures of all this equipment?
No, I don't. I have pictures of the haying equipment, but I don't have pictures of the combine. I certainly know what it looks like, but... And then they would dump the straw out of the back of the combine. There was a well-attended separator, and he would keep the wheat and the stuff going down in the bulker box, which was basically, they were pretty much made out of wood. And then a guy that tended header would raise and lower the header, which was out to the side of the combine, depending on the height of the wheat.
Was the header what cut the wheat?
Well, it was, the header was, yes, it cut it, and then there was a reel that pulled it in, and then it came into the side of the combine. I kind of forgot what some of that terminology was called. And then it went through the combine, and then you had a sack sower who sat back on the, up on the combine. Oh, did they eat dirt. And
these were hot August days.